right, welcome in. 6:05 here on a Wednesday.
Hump day.
It's good to have you. Sun's coming up. There it is.
Hump day.
Yeah. And how about the Pistons?
Hey.
Pistons make a trade up last night in the NBA draft. They go from 21 to 17, and they end up with a guy that I really like. I didn't watch a ton of him, unfortunately, but I do know a little bit about Ibuka Okori.
Yes.
He's a guard out of Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a ton of speed.
And
he plays on the ball, off the ball. He loves to score.
And he scores, he averages about 23 points a game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice.
We need a scorer.
But you know what's funny is, like, the way that this team is built, like, they want to be able to change things up. They want to be able to do different things. Like, we don't always need Cade to bring the ball down the court. I need Cade to play off the ball,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes.
Right? That's
yes.
where somebody like Okori will come in and mm-hmm. give you that option. Jaden Ivey kind of was that. Unfortunately, Jaden Ivey could never stay healthy.
Yeah.
So it gives you that flexibility. He likes to score. He can slash. He's very quick.
And he says he's ready, you know, to bring that defensive intensity as well, because, you know, the Pistons, you know, are big on the defense.
Good, because we're playing defense here. That's how we operate.
That's it.
Yeah. So I like the move. You know, unfortunately, when you get to this point in the draft, it's why the NBA is tough, because if you're not in that top eight, if you're not in the lottery, if you're not, you know, make the argument for maybe 10, 11, 12, you might be stretching it.
Maybe, yeah.
A lot of these guys are going to be, you know, we'll wait and see.
See, yeah.
You know, you stash them and hopefully they develop. But I think that this kid can make a real difference.
Yeah, and I think we can really develop him. I think he's ready. He's prime. And I think we can get him ready to go come, you know, the new season.
Like, is he part of the starting five? No.
No, absolutely not.
No. Not yet.
I wouldn't think so. No.
No. Give him time, though.
Yeah,
But I like the move. And then this was interesting, too.
With the 9th pick in the 2026 NBA draft, the Dallas Mavericks select Morez Johnson Jr. from the University of Michigan.
Wow. Isn't that something?
You know that that scene from The Hangover when he's got all of the different, you know, math equations floating around in his head?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Dusty May to Dallas, and they take, you know, Morez Johnson, huh? It's
absolutely
all connected.
Yes.
Yeah. So
it's just a coincidence.
That's all it is, just a coincidence. So Morez Johnson goes to Dallas at 9. Yaxel goes to the Warriors at 11. I think Adaimara went at 12. So you had three Michigan players in the top 15. That's the first time that's happened to a Big Ten team since, like, the 70s.
Wow.
So a pretty impressive haul there. I mean, we knew that was going to happen.
Sure.
Those guys were going to be, you know, highly sought after players. But still interesting. It was a fun night at the draft.
Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison detailing a stepped-up push to enforce the city's minor curfew rules as officials respond to rising concerns about teen activity and summer violence. Bettison told Detroit City Council yesterday the department recorded 103 curfew violations in April, 92 in May, the number spiking to about 180 during the Ford fireworks event. Ahead of the fireworks, the city put a temporary curfew in place requiring minors to be with an adult after 8 p.m., which ended Tuesday morning. The chief says enforcement is only part of the strategy, with families being connected to support services through the 36th District Court system. He noted parents may be offered alternatives such as responsibility courses and, in some cases, referrals to treatment programs when deeper issues are identified. There were 95 parental responsibility tickets given out during the fireworks. The chief says the goal is to address both violations and underlying challenges driving them while continuing efforts to improve youth safety across the city.
Mm.
Now, you know that big fraud scheme that they announced, the DOJ announced like $6 billion in fraud. Well, four people are facing criminal charges in separate healthcare fraud cases here in Michigan. That's according to the AG's office. Attorney General Dana Nessel announcing the charges yesterday as part of the U.S. Department of Justice's National Healthcare Fraud Takedown, a nationwide effort targeting alleged fraud against Medicaid and other programs. Prosecutors say the cases involve everything from stolen autism service funds to alleged patient neglect and false billing schemes. In Detroit, a contractor is accused of improperly receiving more than $234,000 meant for autism services. In Mount Pleasant, a caregiver is charged with Medicaid fraud after allegedly billing for services that were never provided to a vulnerable elderly man. In Ann Arbor, a pharmacist accused of billing for thousands of medical products that were never purchased. And in Oak Park, a caregiver is accused of billing Medicaid for months of care that was never delivered while living out of state. Nestle says the cases are part of an ongoing effort to protect taxpayer dollars and crack down on Medicaid fraud across Michigan. I just don't know how these people think they can get away with this. You know, I guess they've been getting away with it for so long, they just felt like, oh, well, nobody's paying attention.
This is part of the problem, though. It's like everybody wants free health care, free college, free child care, free this, free that. And that's fine. Free is nice.
Yeah.
I like free.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's great. How do we pay for these programs?
That's it.
Well, one of the ways that we could maybe help pay for some of them is let's crack down on some of this.
Look how much money.
$6 billion.
That's
a lot. No, again, that's not going to take care of all the things I just mentioned. But you want to be able to provide, services for homeless people in Philadelphia or New York or LA or whatever it is.
Right.
Sure. Well, there's some money.
I agree.
And you won't even miss it because it's been gone the whole time.
Right. Exactly. It's free. It's new money, really, because it's been gone. You didn't know it was there, right?
I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, use it then.
Michigan's top leaders say they have reached a tentative framework agreement on the state budget just days ahead of the statutory deadline. Governor Whitmer, Senate Majority Leader Winnie Brinks, and Republican House Speaker Matt Hall all signed off on the outline Monday night. Speaker Hall says the framework would block any new taxes and prohibit the use of the state's rainy day fund, though many key details remain unresolved. Negotiations are still working through major sticking points, including education funding, potential property tax relief, several policy bills tied to the broader deal. Whitmer's office says the agreement puts the state on a path toward a balanced bipartisan budget, but final approval still requires votes in both chambers and the governor's signature. Lawmakers now racing to finalize a full spending plan before that July 1 deadline. Mm. And when we had Matt Hall on, he said he thought that they could get to, a deal. You know, he was just going to talk to Winnie and say, hey, let's make a deal.
Cue the 60 Minutes music.
Tick, 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 tick. Let's make a deal, and then we'll let the governor know that we made a deal.
Or,
then the governor's people said, oh, hey.
Well, hold on.
We're ready.
We can talk.
Yeah.
Jazz Chisholm had a big night last night. Homer had drove in two runs, scored a couple of times. Yankees beat the Tigers last night down at Copa 4-3. Jason, I didn't realize the Yankees could hit home runs outside of Yankee Stadium.
They can, yes.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So can the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I could hit home runs in Yankee Stadium.
Come on.
But everywhere else, it would be a bit of a stretch.
Right.
Yeah. I could throw the ball into the stands at Yankee Stadium.
Are you kidding? Now we got Tarek Skubal on the mound tonight to try to win
another series,
so that's a good thing.
Let's do it.
Yep, rubber match. They look different to me. They look different.
The Tigers look
different?
Okay.
Now, sometimes they, it rears their ugly head.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit of swagger to this team.
Okay.
I don't know.
Swagger or sense of urgency?
Maybe sense of urgency.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. You call it what you will.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But there's a little bit of something there. A little juice. Now, they got a long way to go. They've dug themselves into quite a hole. But
yeah. Well,
there's a little excitement
there's
there.
Some drama.
Yeah.
Come on.
I dig it. Coming up on the other side, information on the Nancy Guthrie case, Savannah Guthrie speaking out on today's show, all that coming up on JR Morning. So investigators both at the county level in Pima County, Arizona, and at the federal level with the FBI are dealing with conflicting ransom note communications tied to the Nancy Guthrie case. There was these notes that were sent to TMZ of all places.
Yeah.
And credit TMZ. I mean, they did a nice job of they tried to give what information they could without giving up all the goods,
yes.
Right? Because it still is an active investigation. There was a second ransom note that came in that reportedly claimed that she died and was buried with nature, though authorities have not been able to confirm the authenticity of that note. Some outlets were reporting that there was an apology from the kidnappers suggesting that her death was unintentional.
Right, they didn't mean to, yeah.
But Harvey Levin went on this like 8-minute diatribe and posted it on social media, and he said that they never received any note that mentioned her death or an apology for her death.
No. It says she was scared.
That she was scared, but okay.
Okay, right.
Is what he said, the note said.
Mm-hmm.
And there were multiple ransom notes sent to TMZ. They forwarded them to federal authorities. They were kind of involved in that investigation because they were acting as some sort of like mediator almost.
Yeah.
If these things were legit.
Mm-hmm.
Then yesterday, Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show issued this new plea.
To ask people to really, to beg people to come forward. Somebody knows something. We are in agony. We cannot be at peace. So no matter how much I try to come out here every day and smile and find that joy, and I will, I promise I will. This is a moment to tell you that we need your help. We're begging for your help.
Mm. Wow.
So again, like she came back to the show way earlier than
most people
here on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still looking for answers, obviously. Daniel Roberts, former FBI assistant director, joins us to talk about it. Daniel, it's good to have you back. When in a case like this, when you've got multiple of these, what they're calling ransom notes, and these tipsters that are demanding money, I think at one point Harvey Levin also said that they had put in a few $100 to a Bitcoin account to try to trace it, but the FBI couldn't.
Yeah.
How do investigators differentiate from a legitimate note and something that people are just trying to probe or get involved in the investigation or just looking for a cash out?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. And good morning, guys. It's difficult. And I know that from experience that a lot of times you receive false notes and false contacts like this, and it's very difficult to figure out which one is real and which one isn't. I have my doubts about notes that would just say, hey, I know she died, but they're not asking for anything. They're not asking for any money. Why would you send a note like that? But it does give law enforcement something to work with. It gives them more evidence to follow up on. You know, there's a lot of work electronically that can be done in terms of tracing the source of where that electronic note came from. It also tells something about the kidnappers too, depending on how the language is written, you know, what the grammar use is like, mm-hmm. What the English spelling is like. So it tells them something a little bit more about the kidnappers. But you're right about that. It's very difficult to find out whether or not it's real versus fake note.
Daniel, Savannah Guthrie was on TV, and she said somebody knows something. From your FBI experience, how often are cases like this ultimately solved because one person finally decides to make that phone call?
You know, honestly, the stats are not in her favor in terms of return of Nancy safe, obviously. The stats would tell you that it's not the more the time passes, that it's not in her favor. Mm-hmm. However, if you look at cases like the Elizabeth Spark kidnapping case, where she was gone for 9 months and returned alive and well, at least physically well. Yeah. You know, so it does happen. So you got to keep hope. The only thing that's good about this notes and the new information that just came out is that it does put the case back on the front burner for a lot of people. Gets them thinking about it again, generates interest. And so maybe there are more tips coming into the tip line that that law enforcement can use to follow up on.
You were heavily involved in that Elizabeth Smart case. Is there anything that you see, any correlation that you see between that case and this case?
You know, there was a lot of things in the beginning that made me think of the Elizabeth Spark case, especially when you started, you know, like in all of those cases, you start from inside the house and you work out. And that's exactly what we did at the Elizabeth Smart case, meaning you start with those that are closest to the victim and work out. People that know her well, that are inside her house, that family, friends, relatives. And it seemed like at the beginning of this case with Nancy Guthrie, they couldn't get away from family members, even some of the family members. And we had the same problem with the Elizabeth Smart case. We could not get off of some of the family members because they just couldn't pass a polygraph, or they just couldn't give us good whereabouts as to where they were that night and things like that. So there was a lot of challenges early on in the investigation that were very similar to the Elizabeth Smart case. However, as time goes on, it appears to be now that this is much more of a straight up kidnapping for money than the Elizabeth Smart case was.
And, you know, when family members publicly acknowledge that their loved one may, you know, not be alive, Does that change the investigative approach, or do investigators continue kind of operating under that every possible scenario?
It doesn't change anything. They are going to follow up on any leads. Yes, I mentioned right off the bat that the stats are not good in her favor in terms of returning her alive, but that doesn't change anything in terms of the law enforcement response. They're still going to follow every lead that comes in, and they're going to run it to the ground no matter what, until they get resolution one way or the other. And like I say, this new news about ransom notes and things like that, or notes coming in talking about her death, at least that generates more interest in the public, and there may be more people willing to talk now and give them some more leads to follow up on.
Daniel Roberts, always appreciate the time and insight. Thank you. We'll talk soon.
All right, good talking to you.
Yeah, you got it.
You as well.
But again, I mean, we're at the point still, you know, here in June, end of June, where Savannah Guthrie's going on the Today Show going, somebody knows something, come forward. And it's like, it tells you a lot about where the investigation is.
It does. But somebody does know something. And whether they just want to come forward and say, or, you know, maybe who knew who did it or was part of it or something, they know something. It's just, when are they going to come out and say something?
AI is becoming so powerful that there is a mea culpa on what could be coming in just the next few months. We'll talk about it next. It's JR Morning. So major Western intelligence alliances like the Five Eyes are warning that advanced AI capable of crippling governments and business security is arriving much faster than expected. Officials are saying that the timeline is not years, that these AI systems that are becoming so powerful that they're going to be able to breach security, you're talking months away.
See, and that's what really jumps out to me, that timeline.
And it's becoming a much bigger issue. And yes, the United States still leads on this front. Anthropic and OpenAI and all of these AI platforms are still the leaders in the world, but that doesn't mean that China isn't catching up.
That doesn't mean
some of our adversaries are catching up. Japan, even their AI capabilities are jumping incredibly quickly. So you've got all of these issues on the board, and the concern is it's not that we're being caught up to. It's the risk of what happens when these tools are available to nefarious actors when it comes to government security, business security, things like that. Brent Yax is the CEO of Aucom and joins us this morning. Brent, it's good to have you back.
Thanks.
Is this just sounding the alarm because people are concerned that AI is becoming too powerful, or is this legitimate, that these systems are becoming, are getting to the point where they're going to be able to be used as a powerful tool from people who have, you know, potential bone to pick with the United States?
Well, I think it's real, and I think it's timely that they put this out because, you know, like you had mentioned, some of the tools in the United States are pretty advanced, especially the new one coming from Anthropic, which is called Mythos. And I think once people saw the capabilities of some of these new advanced AI systems, they realized that this is a real threat that we need to deal with.
You know, and the report suggests that cyber attacks are no longer a matter of if, but when. Has the cybersecurity industry reached a point where, you know, resilience is more important than prevention?
I think we're getting to a point where we've realized that even, you know, lesser agents out there, even people that weren't equipped to do these attacks previously, are now using tools to be able to exploit more businesses. So what's happening is it's moving this discussion of what cyber needs to be into smaller businesses that have never had to really deal with it because they were too small to be a target. Mm-hmm. Now the reality of it is everyone's a target.
So when these officials are saying it could cripple governments or businesses, what does that actually look like?
So what's happening now is that, you know, say, for example, you have these nation states or you have these cyber criminal organizations out there that really couldn't mount such a large attack. Well, cyber's giving them the idea or the ability to find an exploit, to put together an attack, and to mass produce that attack at scale almost instantly. So instead of it taking weeks or months to do that, they're able to do that in hours or days. So now they can go after just a mass group of businesses and really shut down their operations, encrypt everything, steal data, really just put them at risk now for data loss or even stopping the business operations.
Are there common weaknesses that you see when you walk into a company for the first time, like things that make you immediately say this organization is exposed?
Yeah, I mean, some of the big common ones are just, you know, bad passwords. You know, it's still the number one, you know, attack out there is really exploiting old passwords. So reusing passwords is not a good idea. You want to change them often. You want to update systems. You want to patch systems. You want to get rid of legacy software that you have. Those things are all common red flags that we see.
Mm. What's the defense here? Is it simply these companies working with the United States government, working with the business community to try to create a firewall of sorts? I mean, I look at the U.S. military. We don't know what our capabilities are completely. You know, are those defense systems in place that we just don't know of?
Well, I mean, it's just good cyber hygiene. It's the things that we've been doing over time. It's like I said, getting those, you know, passwords changed. It's getting these things called like multi-factor authentication, which is annoying. You know, you try to log in and it buzzes your phone yeah. and you got to say yes.
Yeah.
But those are good hygiene. And I hope, you know, that we can do something with the government. I hope that we can, you know, leverage them to put policies in place and enforce those policies with other nation states, because we're not doing enough right now in that capacity.
Can AI become both the burglar and the security guard? I mean, can the same technology attacking networks also be the best defense against those attacks?
No, absolutely right. And in fact, we are doing that. We are seeing new tools from the AI side in the business to protect the business. In fact, if we look at it historically, the defenders from a technology standpoint usually always win because there's more money invested in the defense than there is the offense. So over time, those AI tools should provide the, you know, the trump card in the situation.
Well, and part of the argument about regulation, particularly from a government perspective, is, well, do we want to regulate what we're doing here at home so that others can catch up around the world? But the realities are, would those regulations be effective against our adversaries if they would try to, you know, cause some sort of havoc?
Right. And that's the balance, right? It's always, do you regulate and slow down innovation, or do you allow innovation and then hopefully let the regulations catch up? And right now we have no regulations really in place. So I'm sort of a person that leans on the latter. I let innovation to drive some of the regulation. But what we need is policy against other countries attacking our businesses. And we don't have that yet.
If a company is listening right now this morning, Brent, and hasn't updated its cybersecurity strategy, let's say in several years, how far behind are they?
AI, I mean, I would argue that they're more behind than they ever have been. The good news is that it's not something that is really difficult to catch up on. There's a few key tools they could do. There's a few key investments they could make, but they really do need to focus on, hey, cyber is real. It is a threat. Even if I was a small business and I didn't think I was going to be attacked, now I might be. So it is something I need to discuss with my executive team.
Brent Yax, the CEO of Aucom, we appreciate your insight as always. Thank you. And we're going to keep an eye on this. We know you will too. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it.
I just think, you know, many people just think that these kind of threats, they assume that it's, you know, the Fortune 500 companies, you know, that are being more vulnerable. But, I mean, listen, local manufacturers, law firms, medical offices, you know, they got to be paying attention to this, too.
Yeah, I mean, you driving into work right now,
mm-hmm.
drinking your coffee, eating your everything bagel, that's you're not impacted by this.
Yeah.
It's the trickle down, though.
It is.
Because if your company gets targeted
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden your operation shut down, well, all of a sudden you don't want to buy that bagel then this morning.
Exactly.
Right? Your paycheck might be in jeopardy.
Uh-huh.
You don't know where you're getting. All of a sudden, then it is your problem.
Yes.
So, you know, there, you know, I've been called like an alarmist on AI, and I don't think it's alarmist. I think it's being realistic.
You got to get in front, man. Out in front.
I think it's just, it's understanding what
behind.
This thing can be. Well,
yes.
No, you can't afford to get behind, and you can't afford to say, well, this is just a flash in the pan. This is nothing. Because
right.
it's not a flash in the pan. It is not nothing.
Uh-uh.
This is where we are going.
Yes.
And I think it's great. But there are some drawbacks to that, including using these tools against businesses or quite frankly, even worse, the U.S. government.
Government, yes.
And we've already seen security breaches in our military,
mm-hmm.
for example.
Mm-hmm.
We've already seen cyber attacks shut down an entire oil pipeline on the Eastern Seaboard.
Yes.
Right? And the ripple effects that has.
Healthcare.
It is very real. Healthcare.
Yeah.
Stryker here in Michigan.
Yes.
Right? So we have seen the ramifications of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very real. Yeah, it's really nice to go, what should I have for dinner? Here's what I have in my pantry, right? You know, create me a menu for tonight.
Yeah.
That's awesome and really valuable. But there's a lot of other things that, you know, you got to keep in mind, too, when it comes to this stuff. And that's certainly one of them. Coming up on the other side, Tucker Carlson, no longer a member of the GOP. We're talking about it. It's Jared Morning. So interesting. Interesting. Intrigue, Lloyd. So Tucker Carlson says he's out on the GOP. Marjorie Taylor Greene had followed suit, saying that Tucker is not the only one who is done supporting the Republican Party. There's a lot of us that are absolutely fed up and will not support a party that betrays its voters and country. That does not mean we are turning into Democrats either, but we are done with the America Last Republican Party.
Wow.
So pretty strong words from a former, I mean, you could make the argument, one of the strongest allies to Donald Trump.
He has been.
And then Tucker Carlson obviously has been singing the praises of Donald Trump for years.
Yes.
And so what are the ripple effects of this? Jason Rose, the political strategist of Rose Strategic, and joins us this morning. Jason, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning, guys. And bye, Felicia, to Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. Sip. He gone. This has to be a real problem for the Republicans, isn't it? And for Donald Trump.
I think it highlights a fracture in the conservative movement over what's going on in Iran. We've seen and documented growing anti-Semitism in both parties. It's really kind of shocking to observe. Tucker Carlson is responsible for a lot of the anti-Semitism festering on the right. He's not only been somebody who has promoted Muslim dictatorships around the world, but he's been platforming people like Nick Fuentes, who's an avowed anti-Semite. You know, there's a few people in the conservative blogosphere or podcaster space that have been promoting this kind of stuff. Megyn Kelly is another one. But they're doing it for clicks. I don't think there's any sincerity about this. You know, Tucker Carlson 20 years ago was a neoconservative Zionist. And, you know, everything that he does is, you know, in the last many years has been about monetizing his platforms. And I think this is the kind of thing that for him gets him more clicks, gets him more subscribers, and makes him more money. So I don't think it's sincere. I think it's calculated, and I think it's driven by money.
Carlson argues, Jason, that the Republican leaders are making decisions based on donors and foreign interests and political elites rather than voters. Is that criticism, is that resonating with portions of the Republican base, you think?
Yeah, unfortunately, it is resonating because there are people that don't really understand geopolitical situations. You know, when you look at Iran, I was supportive of the attack on Iran. I was supportive of the first 3 weeks. And then we got into this foolish ceasefire, which allowed the Iranian Revolutionary Guard to retrench and seize control of the Strait of Hormuz. And, you know, we've negotiated a so-called peace deal that is puts, you know, the U.S. in a worse position than it was before the attack. So I think it's a terrible deal for America, but it's not driven by Israel. It's driven by American interests. I mean, Iran has been responsible for every terrorist attack against the West, and I mean the West broadly, and not just Israel, but, you know, I think for the United States. 47 years we've been dealing with what they've been doing. So I think this was something very much driven by American interests. Israel is our strongest ally on the planet. I would say stronger than the United Kingdom. And, you know, that's a pretty strong statement. But their position in the Middle East has been strategically important for us for a lot of reasons. At the United Nations, they've been our most steadfast ally. This has been in our interest. Just because it's also in Israel's interest doesn't change the fact that it benefits us. But, you know, it's unfortunate that these actors are the ones that are, you know, suggesting that U.S. foreign policy is dictated by Israel. It's a pretty old trope. It's not anything new. It's just been resurfaced by people who were previously very pro-Israel.
I have to imagine Democrats just must be hearing Vivaldi in their heads or something. This is one of the greatest things for them, because it's not like Democrats are entirely popular. They're still incredibly unpopular amongst the American electorate. But if you've got influential figures that are abandoning Donald Trump, that are abandoning the Republican Party, it feels like that when you get to November, this could get ugly.
Well, it is a gift to Democrats. I mean, it's well documented that, you know, there is a segment of Trump-only voters that don't turn out in midterm elections. And those voters are going to be critical to Republican successes in this upcoming election. And so you have this kind of a split, and you have, MAGA-aligned voters believing that the Republican Party has abandoned the United States and in this space just carrying water for Israel. That's going to affect their turnout. So this is a gift to Democrats. And, you know, I think maybe Tucker Carlson thinks that in a Democratic majority country, you know, his program becomes even more critical. But at this point, to me, he's just more of a propagandist, pushing conspiracy theories. And I think stirring up people that again, I don't think have a real handle on geopolitics.
But how concerned should Republican candidates be if a portion of the base begins identifying more with media personalities than the party itself?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think both parties are struggling with their identities and who the voices of their parties are. I mean, you're seeing a lot of turmoil within the Democratic Party that Republicans have been pulling out their popcorn and enjoying. So it's happening on both sides. And, you know, I think you look at the realignment that came with Trump, a lot of working class voters that were, you know, typically aligned with Democrats found that, you know, the Democratic Party became something they didn't recognize and have moved to the right. You know, so we've got to probably look for, you know, voters within the electorate that are available to Republicans that haven't been in the past when we get these kinds of fractures amongst our base voters.
Interesting stuff as always, Jason. We appreciate your time and insight. Thank you. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. You know, and the question here is the course correction.
Uh-huh.
Because remember, we had Mallory McMorrow on the show yesterday.
Yes.
And I think I'd asked her about what's it like being in a primary like this.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, Abdul Al-Sayed is far too progressive. He's way off, way, 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 way off.
Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, Haley Stevens, who's a Chuck Schumer Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So the identity crisis there in a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And yes, she's trying to paint herself as the middle ground of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the realities are that's where Democrats are. So when Donald Trump gets this opposition from these influential figures.
Yeah.
And I tend to agree with Jason a little bit.
Uh-huh.
The fact that, you know, how much of this is self-serving?
Well, I mean,
for these folks.
Yeah. Come on.
For Tucker Carlson able to then have a Democrat majority in Congress, and all of a sudden he's got a whole host of other things to talk about.
Does this affect the midterms, too?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Yeah.
7 o'clock hours next. It's JR Morning. Here's your chance to win a trip to see two country superstars, Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan in Vegas. Double the hits, one unforgettable night. We've got your flights, hotel, and concert tickets covered. A double down tour, Aldean and Bryan co-headlining with special guest John Pardee and Chase Matthews, all live under neon lights. It's provided by BBR Music Group. Texas Hours national keyword WIDE to 95819. That's WIDE to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Official rules and more info are at WJR.com. Meanwhile, Pistons.
Pistonians.
Draft last night, NBA draft last night, and now we have the newest member of this team, and it is guard Ibuka Okori from Stanford. And I watched a couple of different Stanford games this year. Really like this kid.
Okay.
He's got speed.
Mm-hmm.
He's got handles.
Which is nice.
Yeah, he could turn on the gas when he's got the handles too,
yes,
which is good.
Which is great.
They need somebody who can move the ball quickly down the court.
Other than Cade.
I mean, Cade's a little more deliberate.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need a little speed. And that's what Okori will be able to provide. Again, is he going to be an impact player day one? I don't know. Probably not.
Probably not.
But he'll be a nice piece coming off the bench for a little while until he gets his bearings.
Because our bench is pretty nice. And so we got him coming off as well.
And again, this is just the draft.
Yeah.
Right? And these are the players that you're going to see get the most headlines. And then as you go further in the draft, they're going to the G League, things like that.
Sure.
They're a developmental project.
Exactly.
But at the same time, I think you get a real piece here. And they moved up to get him from 21 up to 17.
To me, that's being aggressive.
It's aggressive. It's identifying somebody you like, somebody you think that fits in your scheme, somebody you think that's going to fit into the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
And you're assertive enough to go get it. So I like it. And then, of course, you had three Michigan players go in the top 15. First time a Big Ten team has sent three players to the NBA within that portion of the NBA draft board back to the 70s when the Indiana Hoosiers did it. Merez Johnson Jr. gets picked up by his old coach.
With the ninth pick in the 2026 NBA draft, the Dallas Mavericks select Merez Johnson Jr. from the University of Michigan.
It was just coincidence.
Just happened to be there at the right time.
I'm just
so Dusty may love himself. Some
boy, that Michigan
Merez
team
Johnson.
Really dismantled a lot in the last 2 days. Yeah,
yeah, good Lord.
Yak to Lendeborg goes to the Warriors.
Is the Chrysler Center still standing?
We don't know. It actually it's just the Dallas North is what it is.
Right,
now.
Exactly.
Yeah. But Yaxel goes 11th to the Warriors, and then Adaimar goes at number 12. So those are the big pieces off the board for Michigan.
A lot of Supreme Court rulings yesterday, more to come, but the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a Michigan family's claim that it was shortchanged in a county tax foreclosure sale, but says the case can continue in lower courts. In a unanimous opinion, Justice Samuel Alito wrote that Isabella County was not required to base compensation on a home's fair market value, even if it sold for significantly less at auction. The case involves a Union Township property that was sold for about $76,000 to cover a tax bill of just over $2,000 before being resold for nearly $195,000. The court said tax sale proceeds are constitutionally acceptable if the auction is conducted fairly, but left open whether that standard was met in this case. The Pung family argues that sale violated their constitutional rights, while county officials say the process followed state law and proper procedure. The case now returns to a lower court for further review of whether the auction itself was conducted fairly.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some of those other Supreme Court cases as well in the 8 o'clock hour with Richard Friedman at the University of Michigan. Also, this health care fraud scheme that was announced yesterday by the Department of Justice, FBI, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a part of that press conference as well. $6 billion in fraud, and there's a Michigan connection.
Absolutely. Four people facing criminal charges and health care fraud cases here in Michigan. In Detroit, a contractor accused of improperly receiving more than $234,000 meant for autism services. In Mount Pleasant, a caregiver is charged with Medicaid fraud after allegedly billing for services that were never provided to a vulnerable elderly man. In Ann Arbor, a pharmacist is accused of billing for thousands of medical products that were never purchased. And in Oak Park, a caregiver is accused of billing Medicaid for months of care that was never delivered while living out of state. And those charges being filed by AG Dana Nessel yesterday.
Yeah. Those curfew numbers, there were still a lot of kids out there, some violations that the Detroit police did dole out during the fireworks.
Yeah, and Chief Bettison appeared before Detroit City Council yesterday to talk about the curfew violations through April, May, and also at the Ford fireworks. Now, in April, they had 103 curfew violations. In May, there were 92. And then for the Ford fireworks event on Monday, there were 180 fireworks night, 180 citations ahead of the fireworks. The city put that temporary curfew in place. Minors had to be off the streets or with an adult by 8 p.m. The chief says enforcement only part of the strategy, with families also being connected to support services through 36th District Court, because in some cases, you know, there are deeper issues than just the parents letting their kids out for curfew, you know, and getting involved with the curfew. And so there are some deeper things. And so they're trying to help them with that, too. There were 95 parental responsibility tickets handed out as well.
Mm. Yankees beat the Tigers yesterday down at Comerica Park 4-3. Jed Chisholm had a nice night. Rubber match tonight. Tarek Skubal on the bump, 640 first pitch tonight.
Let's do it. Let's just win the series.
Also, make sure you're listening at 8:49 this morning. We've got Name That Tune coming up.
Yay!
And we got a stay-and-play package for you for two in beautiful Marine City, courtesy of the Inn on Water Street Anthem Coast Theater. So make sure you're
always a great time there.
Dialed in. Get your what is that app called? Shazam. Actually, don't use Shazam. Let's not encourage that. No cheating allowed during Name That Tune. You gotta be a real music head.
Oh my God.
Well, I mean,
we got a good one today.
How would we know?
I think so.
Yeah. All right, good. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. There's an often overlooked but highly effective marketing channel that you simply have to consider these days if you're in business. And that channel is text messaging, or SMS marketing, as it's known in the trade. In 2026, 86% of consumers opted into business text messages, and 75% of businesses say they're using SMS marketing as an effective marketing channel, showing growth from last year. Based on those statistics, among others, which I'll get to in a second, it's safe to say that texting has confirmed its place as a core channel in the marketing mix. SimpleTexting.com surveyed 1,000 consumers and 400 SMS marketers to uncover hot topics that we all want to know when it comes to whether or not text marketing works and how to best utilize it. Here are some key insights from that survey that make clear SMS marketing works indeed. Number one, 65% of businesses already using SMS marketing say they plan on increasing their budgets next year for this channel. Two, two-thirds of businesses have an average SMS marketing click-through rate of 20% or higher. Number three, customer service and support. Well, they're the most common business uses for text message marketing. How effective is it? Well, most businesses say they attribute 21 to 30% of their revenue to text message marketing. Yeah, but it only works if consumers opt in, right? Well, of course, that's true. How about this? In 2026, 86% of consumers are opted in to texts from at least one business. That's nearly a 40% growth from 2021. And 62% of consumers receive text messages they've opted in for from four or more businesses. What are the hottest categories? E-commerce, retail, healthcare, and finance are the top three categories when it comes to SMS marketing use. What are the primary uses? Appointment reservation reminders, shipment and order tracking, and promotions are the top reasons why consumers say they are willing to opt in to text messages from businesses. So there you have it, a channel you just have to try if you're in business today. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
Well, you're talking about big-time fraud, big-time healthcare fraud to the tune of $6.5 billion. Prosecutors announced those charges yesterday. 450 defendants in this alleged fraud spanning Medicaid and hospice care. The Justice Department charged these 450 defendants totaling over $6.5 billion, spans 57 federal courts, 41 states, 90 medical professionals, and this new data-sharing agreement with the FTC, Homeland Security, CMS, to expand fraud detection. They said that there just basically wasn't any fraud detection.
Yeah.
And these people were allowed to just fly under the radar.
And that's why they kept doing it and did it to that amount of money. That's a lot of money.
Matthew Schneider is a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan and joins us this morning. Matthew, it's good to have you back.
Thank you for having me back. Nice to be here.
This was some staggering numbers that they were talking about yesterday. Hundreds of people involved in this, and to the tune of a lot of money. Is it fair to paint the picture that this fraud was able to just go under the radar based on what you've seen?
Well, not entirely, because a lot of these people were in fact charged by either the federal government or the states. And so whether it went under the radar, ultimately, a lot of these people got caught. And what's significant of this is not just that they were 455 defendants charged in this, or that there was over $6 billion that was involved, is this is an annual event that the Justice Department and the states get together to do. So this type of event it happened last year, it happened the year before, and it's going to happen in the future. That's really the problem to identify, that there is so much fraud that you have to do this at least once a year to have this huge kickoff, and it's not going away. And I think that's the larger problem.
Matthew, you know, when most people hear Medicare fraud, they think of the paperwork mistakes or maybe some billing errors. But this case, I mean, you got kickbacks, telemarketers, fake medical necessity. How sophisticated have these schemes become now?
The more sophisticated the medical practice gets with billing and coding, the more sophisticated the criminals are getting because they're adapting to that. They're using AI. So they're using a lot of the tools that we use to benefit ourselves with electronic patient records. And the criminals are sometimes tapping into those, manipulating codes. It's very sophisticated, and it's now also expanding to networks. It's not like there are just a few individuals doing this. It's really another aspect of organized crime where you have a whole network, maybe even a network in a foreign country, who are tapping into an American electronic data system to mm-hmm. commit these crimes.
Mm-hmm. So to your point of this needing to be an annual thing that the DOJ has to do, with so many people being charged, does this act as a deterrent into the future? Does it highlight that there is a real lens on it, or has there always been an eye on this?
It should act as an deterrent. I always think that when you do these types of rollouts and kickoffs of these large prosecutions, it raises awareness that people are watching. And so it should act as a deterrent. Now, of course, it's not going to stop all the people. But then again, that's always the case. We can charge political corruption cases. You can charge bribery cases. That will continue to happen. It's whether or not the impact is strong enough to really deter people. And that's really the hope of the federal and the state governments.
You know, for healthcare providers, Matthew, who operate legitimately, what kind of compliance measures should they have in place to avoid becoming, you know, entangled in these questionable arrangements?
It's a great question because most healthcare providers operate appropriately. I mean, that's really a big point to make here. There are bad apples that got caught and are being charged, but the grand majority of healthcare providers and doctors and physicians, they're doing the right thing. Sometimes they have nefarious employees, or sometimes they don't have the proper systems to know whether or not their data is being hacked. When you have a data hack like that, you also have to report that to the state authorities. If you have an intrusion in your systems, you've got to report that, for example, to the state attorney general. And if a medical provider decides that they don't want to be embarrassed by that and they don't want to report it, that's also the problem, because ultimately that's another way to solve this issue. But for providers to not follow the law is one of the reasons why we're in this situation.
Well, and the really unfortunate thing is you're looking at these 90 medical professionals that were charged with these schemes ranging from like wound care to opioid distribution. Mm-hmm. These are people that we trust for our medical care, and they've, you know, been accused of submitting over $500 million in false Medicaid claims. Is there any sort of glimmer of hope that we're going to be able to claw back some of this money?
It's possible, but the restitution and forfeiture process is extremely difficult. As we saw in this press release and the press conference yesterday, some of that money is gone, because they spent it on lavish vacations and meals and trips. You can never recover that money. However, they have recovered some jewelry. They've recovered a Ferrari. You can get those items back. But even so, the process for the government to seize those things, that could take years. And then they auction it off, and then that takes even longer to get the money back to where it's supposed to go. So it is a margin that returns. It's just not always a great margin.
And, you know, when you look at the sheer size of this nationwide takedown, Matthew, does it suggest the system is working because investigators caught these schemes, or does it reveal just how vulnerable our healthcare system remains?
It does show that it's working, but it's also important to note that there are two really distinctive types of crimes here. One is billing for unnecessary tests. That just keeps happening, and the enforcement of that isn't great. But these other types of things that cause real harm to patients. For example, not giving them the health care that they're supposed to be getting or giving them the wrong medication. That's something that is addressed more seriously by the federal and state governments, because you could really cause damage and cause serious patient harm to people. So they're tending to focus more on that, where it causes a physical harm to somebody. And they're a little bit sometimes getting the money that is going out is getting a little bit of out of hand. That's it's just harder to catch that sometimes.
We just have 30 seconds left here. Jacob Foster, the acting chief of the DOJ's healthcare fraud unit, called it a cat and mouse game. Is there anything legitimately that they can put down as a framework to prevent this then?
Yeah, I know, Jacob. I think that's right. I'd also describe it as a whack-a-mole game. Mm. And so the more mallets that you have to hit the moles, the better. Now, that's expensive to hire these prosecutors, to hire these agents. But right now we're in a period of the federal government where they're decreasing agents and decreasing enforcement numbers. But I think the Justice Department and other people are realizing we do really need these government servants.
Something tells me it would cost less than $6.5 billion.
Yes,
exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah. Matthew Schneider, always appreciate it. Thank you for the insight.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, it would significantly less.
Significantly less.
$6 billion.
And I don't know that for sure, but I'm pretty sure it wouldn't cost $6.5 billion. Coming up on the other side, something isn't adding up in this Nancy Guthrie case. We'll talk about it with Daniel Roberts. It's JR Morning. So investigators both at the county level in Pima County, Arizona, and at the federal level with the FBI are dealing with conflicting ransom note communications tied to the Nancy Guthrie case. There was these notes that were sent to TMZ of all places.
Yeah.
And credit TMZ. I mean, they did a nice job of not, you know, they tried to give what information they could without giving up all the goods.
Yes.
Right. Because it was still is an active investigation. There was a second ransom note that came in that reportedly claimed that she died and was buried with nature, though authorities have not been able to confirm the authenticity of that note. Some outlets were reporting that there was an apology from the kidnappers, suggesting that her death was unintentional.
Right, they didn't mean to, yeah.
But Harvey Levin went on this, like, 8-minute diatribe and posted it on social media, and he said that they never received any note that mentioned her death or an apology for her death.
No, it says she was scared.
That she was scared, but okay.
Okay, right.
Is what he said the note said.
Mm-hmm.
And there were multiple ransom notes sent to TMZ. They forwarded them to federal authorities. They were kind of involved in that investigation because they were acting as some sort of like mediator almost.
Yeah.
If these things were legit.
Mm-hmm.
Then yesterday, Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show issued this new plea.
To ask people to really to beg people to come forward. Somebody knows something. We are in agony. And we cannot be at peace. So no matter how much I try to come out here every day and smile and find that joy, and I will, I promise I will. This is a moment to tell you that we need your help. We're begging for your help.
Mm.
Wow.
So again, like she came back to the show way earlier than
most people
thought.
I
know we thought for sure here on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still looking for answers, obviously. Daniel Roberts, former FBI assistant director, joins us to talk about it. Daniel, it's good to have you back. When in a case like this, when you've got multiple of these, what they're calling ransom notes and these tipsters that are demanding money, I think at one point Harvey Levin also said that they had put in a few hundred dollars to a Bitcoin account to try to trace it, but the FBI couldn't.
Yeah.
How do investigators differentiate from a legitimate note and something that people are just trying to probe or get involved in the investigation or just looking for a cash out?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And good morning, guys. It's difficult. And I know that from experience that a lot of times you receive false notes and false contacts like this, and it's very difficult to figure out which one is real and which one isn't. I have my doubts about notes that would just say, hey, I know she died, but they're not asking for anything. They're not asking for any money. Why would you send a note like that? But it does give law enforcement something to work with. It gives them more evidence to follow up on. You know, there's a lot of work electronically that can be done in terms of tracing the source of where that electronic note came from. It also tells something about the kidnappers, too, depending on how the language is written, you know, what the grammar use is like, what the English spelling is like. So it tells them something a little bit more about the kidnappers. But you're right about that. It's very difficult to find out whether or not it's real versus fake note.
Daniel, Savannah Guthrie was on TV, and she said somebody knows something. From your FBI experience, how often are cases like this ultimately solved because one person finally decides to make that phone call?
You know, honestly, the stats are not in her favor in terms of return of Nancy safe. Obviously, the stats would tell you that it's not the more the time passes, that it's not in her favor. Mm-hmm. However, if you look at cases like the Elizabeth Spark kidnapping case, where she was gone for 9 months and returned alive and well, at least physically well, so it does happen. So you got to keep hope. The only thing that's good about this notes and the new information that just came out is that it does put the case back on the front burner for a lot of people, gets them thinking about it again, generates interest. And so maybe there are more tips coming into the tip line that that law enforcement can use to follow up on.
You were heavily involved in that Elizabeth Smart case. Is there anything that you see, any correlation that you see between that case and this case?
You know, there was a lot of things in the beginning that made me think of the Elizabeth Spark case, especially when you started, you know, like in all of those cases, you start from inside the house and you work out. And that's exactly what we did at the Elizabeth Spark case, meaning you start with those that are closest to the victim and work out. People that know her well, that are inside her house, that family, friends, relatives. And it seemed like at the beginning of this case with Nancy Guthrie, they couldn't get away from family members, even some of the family members. And we had the same problem with the Elizabeth Smart case. We could not get off of some of the family members because they just couldn't pass a polygraph, or they just couldn't give us good whereabouts as to where they were that night and things like that. So there was a lot of challenges early on in the investigation that were very similar to the Elizabeth Smart case. However, as time goes on, it appears to be now that this is much more of a straight up kidnapping for money than the Elizabeth Smart case was.
And, you know, when family members publicly acknowledge that their loved one may, you know, not be alive, does that change the investigative approach, or do investigators continue kind of operating under that every possible scenario?
It doesn't change anything. They are going to follow up on any leads. Yes, I mentioned right off the bat that the stats are not good in her favor in terms of returning her alive, but that doesn't change anything in terms of the law enforcement response. They're still going to follow every lead that comes in, and they're going to run it to the ground no matter what, until they get resolution one way or the other. And like I say, this new news about ransom notes and things like that, or notes coming in talking about her death, at least that generates more interest in the public, and there may be more people willing to talk now and give them some more leads to follow up on.
Daniel Roberts, always appreciate the time and insight. Thank you. We'll talk soon.
All right, good talking to you.
Yeah, you got it.
You as well.
Coming up on the other side, you know, there is an effort in Jackson to help the fire department replace aging equipment to train new firefighters in the region. And lawmakers are working on it. We'll talk about that as part of our Capitol Report next on JR Morning. Well, police in Jackson, rather, firefighters in Jackson have been sounding the alarm that they need some new equipment. It's old. It's outdated. One of their current towers is 65 years old. It's reached the end of its usable life. Their structures are deteriorating. They're outdated. They need modern training needs.
Yeah, they train a lot of firefighters.
Yes,
right?
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the reality is that they need more. They need something new. And it's become a flashpoint for Representative Kathy Schmaltz, who is working to get state funding to help the Jackson Fire Department replace some of this aging equipment that is used to train firefighters in the region. And Representative Schmaltz joins us here this morning. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about what Jackson is facing in terms of their needs. What type of infrastructure, what type of supplies do they currently have, and how far behind the ball are they here?
Well, they're not behind the ball right now, but they do, you know, the fire tower, I've been out there, and it's 65 years old, and it's crumbling, and it's just not safe anymore, and it needs to be updated. So we have a request in for $1.2 million to update the tower. And what it would be is, you know, they would practice all emergency situations so they would be prepared if anything happens. Like, it would be built almost like a house where you would have different situations like blackouts and situations or rapid intervention or other high-risk emergency response skills. So they practice that in a controlled environment so that when they really get a call that they know what they're doing. So this is really important. We train about 400 first responders in our area and, you know, around the region. And, it, you know, when you have something that's outdated like that, it puts everybody in jeopardy because they don't get to train properly. And so we just want to make sure we have a modern facility. They're still training, obviously, because they want to be ready for any emergency situation. But this is about firefighter and civilian safety.
Yeah, because the current facility is described as deteriorating and no longer meeting modern standards. Is there a concern that firefighters themselves could be at risk while training in this existing tower? Yeah.
Of course. They're very careful, obviously, because they know, you know, what kind of shape the tower is in. And so they take precautions with that. They still train on it. But and we also train, you know, all first responders, police, fire, even those who are in ISD programs or career center who are, you know, trying to be first responders and firefighters. They train there, too. So it really is needed for the region. Most places have in the state have a regional, I would say out of 83 counties, there's about 20 that are actually state regional towers. And then you have different ones at community colleges. Some firefighters actually use abandoned buildings and things like that to train in so that they can get experience. But it's really important because we want them to be ready when we call and we have an emergency.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up those other hubs because are they in the same situation as Jackson? Have they gotten other funding in the past and now kind of Jackson's up for that money?
I don't know what their situation is. I haven't heard of anyone coming forward and asking for something like this.
Okay.
But I knew it was a real need in my area. Mm-hmm. And again, it's about safety for everyone. And we want to make sure that our first responders, you know, have what they need to do their job. That's important.
As lawmakers negotiate the state budget, have you had, you know, any arguments resonating with your colleagues regarding this request?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. This is one of the requests that, and of course, with us in the House, especially, we are really advocates for our law enforcement, fire, and our corrections officers, too. We really need to back them. I mean, their jobs are not easy, and if we didn't have them, we certainly would be facing a lot more problems. So we're real advocates in trying to help them out. I have a request for our police department and our sheriff's department, too, and I do believe I've already got that in the budget. So, you know, we're fighting for the fire tower, too. We just want to make sure everybody stays safe, and that includes our firefighters.
Yeah, certainly would be money well spent.
If the funding is approved, what would the timeline look like to demolition of the old tower?
Our chief, Tim Gonzalez, did testify with me. He didn't exactly say the timeline. He did say that would cost about, I think, $200,000 to demolish the building, and then they would start, you know, building the new one.
Uh-huh.
Usually we like, you know, when we get something in the state budget now, we want it used in the next year because that's important. We don't want
sure.
the, you know, if the money's needed that badly, we want you to use it right away.
Right.
Representative Kathy Schmaltz, thanks so much for your time this morning. We appreciate it. Keep us up to date on this.
Great. And it was nice talking to you.
Have yeah, you as well.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Meanwhile, the head of the United Nations nuclear watchdog, Rafael Grossi, says inspectors will soon be allowed to visit Iran's nuclear enrichment sites. As part of this new memorandum of understanding between the United States and Iran, the inspections are, you know, we've talked about it. They're a major part of this deal.
Yeah.
That both J.D. Vance and President Donald Trump have talked about. Iran says that they didn't agree to that. But now, from the horse's mouth, we've got the IAEA saying that they will go in and look at this. Grossi says they don't know exactly when, but they are going to happen, and they are essential to overseeing Iran's nuclear activity to ensure compliance with the agreement.
Okay, all right, we'll see. I mean, the IAEA.
You sound.
I'm just saying, didn't they go in during the old deal that we had with the Obama deal?
The JCPOA.
Yeah. Didn't they go in then, too?
Yes.
But they were still, people still said that they were still making
Yeah, well, they were
still doing stuff.
There
and
were
hiding.
Questions about how often they were going in, whether they were going to the right places, things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. No questions this time, right?
What are you saying?
I'm just saying.
Say it. What do you mean?
No questions about where they're going and how many, you know.
Well, it seems like we're still a little short on details. Like, yeah. They don't know when they're going in, but they said they will be allowed to go in. And again, what does that mean? Are they going to the right places? I don't love the fact that they're talking about downgrading this enriched uranium as opposed to just taking it out.
Exactly. No,
but that's
a
whole other ball of wax. I told you, I don't love this deal. Yeah. I mean, to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's not what at least I expected.
Mm-hmm.
But this deal calls for Iran to dilute that enriched uranium. And there are disputes amongst that as well.
A lot of it is supposedly deep underground. So it's going to take, you know, some type of equipment or something to go and get it, right?
Correct. Correct. It almost feels like this is like boilerplate stuff
mm-hmm.
as part of a broader deal. Now, whether that's good enough is a whole other question and a whole other conversation. Because, yes, the IAEA was in Iran during the JCPOA.
Right. Yeah.
But yet, Iran was still producing enriched uranium.
Exactly.
So either they didn't do a good enough job or Iran was doing a really good job of hiding it.
Yeah.
One way or the other, it doesn't accomplish the goal of making sure Iran's nuclear program is dismantled and that they don't have the ability.
And just because they can go in, just because they say they could go in and do it and search and, you know, verify doesn't mean.
Sure.
It's going to happen.
Yeah, fair enough. Big decisions from the Supreme Court yesterday. We'll talk about that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Get you caught up on the headlines. Also, World Cup fever. U.S. plays tomorrow. What's next on JR Morning? All right, 8 o'clock hour. Good to have you. And we've got Name That Tune coming up this hour.
Yay!
As well. We've got tickets to give away and a stay and play package for the Inn on Water Street and Thumb Coast Theaters. Footloose, the production.
So, Footloose.
Yes.
Footloose.
They do a fantastic job.
They do.
Up there in
always.
Marine
Whatever
City.
They do, yeah, it's always
true.
Great.
It's very, very good. And the Inn on Water Street is a lovely hotel, by the way.
It really is.
So make sure you're listening at 8:49. Give you an opportunity to win that. But NBA draft last night, Pistons make a trade up. They go out and they pick up what they think is going to be a piece to this team. And comes in the way of Ibuka Okori. He's mm-hmm. a guard out of Stanford. 6'1". I've seen some of the criticisms online about him. Like, we don't need another small guard. I don't think that they envision him, at least as of yet,
okay,
being a starting player on this team.
Mm-mm.
I don't think he's going to be a starting guard. He's going to be another option off the bench. You trade up to go get him from 21 to 17, and away you go. He's 19 years old. I like it because he's got good handles. He's got good patience. He can score the basketball. What? He's averaging 23 points a game. And he's got speed. So I'm good with all of those things. I think those are things that they need. Now, I don't think that this team is ready yet either. But this is a piece of draft night, and I think they went out and got somebody that at that portion of the draft board is going to be helpful for them.
Do you think the Pistons will go after a vet from somewhere?
I think they need to.
Yeah.
You know, the Giannis trade went through with Miami,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that, you know, there was rumblings that Detroit may be part of that, you
trade,
know, may enter
yeah.
a third team in that deal.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, which is fine. But now they've got, you know, they got to go out and get a scorer.
Yeah.
You know, I think the absence of Malik Beasley hurt them.
That did.
This year.
Yes, I
now,
agree.
He had his own problems
issues.
Going on that prohibited from being on the basketball court.
True.
But again, you lose a scorer like that, that would have been really, especially the playoffs, would have been valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they got to go out and get somebody that can score the ball, for sure.
Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison detailing that stepped up push to enforce the city's minor curfew rules. Officials responding to rising concerns about teen activity and summer violence. The chief was in front of city council yesterday, and he said the department recorded 103 curfew violations in April, 92 in May, and the numbers spiking to about 180 during the Ford fireworks event. Ahead of the fireworks, city put a temporary curfew in place requiring minors to be with an adult after 8 p.m. That ended Tuesday morning. The chief says enforcement is only part of the strategy. He says with families being connected to support services through 36th District Court, he says parents may be offered alternatives such as responsibility courses and in some cases referrals to treatment programs when deeper issues are identified. There were 95 parental responsibility tickets given during the Ford fireworks as well.
Hmm. Interesting.
Four people facing criminal charges in separate health care fraud cases, according to the Michigan AG's office. Attorney General Dana Nessel announcing charges yesterday as part of the U.S. Department of Justice's national health care fraud takedown, a nationwide effort targeting alleged fraud against Medicaid and other programs. In Detroit, yet a contractor who is accused of improperly receiving more than $234,000 meant for autism services. In Mount Pleasant, yet a caregiver who's charged with Medicaid fraud after allegedly billing for services that were never provided to a vulnerable elderly man. In Ann Arbor, a pharmacist is accused of billing for thousands of medical products that were never purchased. And in Oak Park, a caregiver is accused of billing Medicaid for months of care that was never delivered while living out of state. Nessel says the cases are part of that ongoing effort to protect taxpayer dollars and crack down on Medicaid fraud across Michigan. That's like $6 billion altogether when you talk about all of this fraud that has gone down into Medicare.
Yeah, certainly. And we talked to Matthew Schneider about it, and you can go to WJR.com and listen to that. But, you know, he said this is something every year that they have to do. And $6.5 billion is a lot of money.
It's a lot.
And if there was a system in place where you would be able to catch this sooner, you cannot stop all fraud, right? There are going to be fraud claims that are going to get through, and you're going to end up losing money on it.
Yeah.
But what you don't want to get to the point is where these people that are committing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud then are able to go out and go to Turks and Caicos for a vacation or go to Bali for a vacation or buy a Ferrari.
Because all of that money you can't get back, the dinners and the vacations and stuff, but you can jewelry and cars, those kind of things, homes.
Yeah. And if a $100,000 claim gets through, but you've got a red light in the bureau that goes off when it does, well, all of a sudden it makes it a lot easier to catch the fraud earlier on and all that money isn't gone.
A troubling new report shows children's well-being has declined in Michigan and 28 other states since the pandemic. The 2026 Kids Count Data Book ranks Michigan 34th overall for child wellness, driven by a sharp drop in education. Three quarters of Michigan's fourth graders are now struggling with reading proficiency. The state also outpaces the national average in childhood poverty, with 18% of local kids living in impoverished homes. Health remains Michigan's brightest spot, ranking 21st nationally with below average child and teen death rates. Researchers say the data proves state policy and investment directly dictate how our kids fare.
Mm. Well, this has become a problem, not just in Michigan, in many other states.
Yes.
But the well-being of our kids, and a lot of it starts with social media and the type of access they have to different, whether it's school or food or whatever it is, all of these things play a role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say we may have some movement on a state budget.
You know what? When we talked to Matt Hall yesterday, he kind of said that, we probably can still, get to a deal. And the leader says they have reached a tentative framework agreement for the state budget. Governor Whitmer, Senate Majority Leader Winnie Brinks, Republican House Speaker Matt Hall all signed off on the outline late Monday night. Speaker Hall says the framework would block any new taxes, prohibit use of the state's rainy day fund, though many details still remain unresolved. Negotiators are still working through some major sticking points, including education funding, potential property tax relief, several policy bills tied to the broader deal. And the governor's office says the agreement puts the state on the path toward a balanced bipartisan budget, but final approval still requires votes in both chambers and also the governor's signature. And they are now racing to finalize that full spending plan, Chris, before the July 1 deadline,
which will be here
in a second.
Yeah. Where are we at? A week from today. A week from today. That's when it's due. And then, of course, you go into the shutdown. You do that whole song and dance.
Hopefully you don't want to do that again.
I think last year they were able to put an extension on it, like a week-long extension.
They did.
So we avoided it, and they did eventually get it done, but we'd like to avoid that as much as possible.
I mean, we know what we need to do. And so the framework is there. So now we just need to do it.
Tigers lose yesterday down at Comerica Park to the Yankees 4-3. Rubber match today. 6:40 first pitch down at Comerica Park. Tarek Skubal on the bump tonight.
Okay. We're looking forward to that. And as our sports guy would say, the Stankies.
Yes. Yes. Steve Courtney and the Stankies. I will say, you think Scoobles, who is he going to yell at this time? His last outing against the White Sox, he was John at the, sure at the bench.
They better make all the plays behind him, or they could, you know. Hey, five games out of the wild card, Chris Lloyd.
This guy. Okay.
Looking good.
Okay. This guy.
Only 11 games under 500, but 5 games out of the playoff.
You got to look. You got to look at. You got to be
optimistic.
What's
going on in the AL this year?
There's not many teams with a 500 record.
No, it is. You know? It is crazy.
It's the Dodgers. It's like the Phillies, and it's everybody else.
Everybody.
Dodgers are just too good.
The Dodgers are really good.
Mm-hmm.
The Dodgers are really good.
Mm-hmm. And watch, they'll add big time players at the deadline. You know?
Yeah, of course they will. They want another one. Coming up on the other side, Richard Freeman, the law professor at the University of Michigan, joins us. A number of consequential rulings from the Supreme Court yesterday. We'll talk about it. Share morning. All right, so the Supreme Court came out with a bunch of different rulings yesterday.
Yes.
And one with even a Michigan connection.
That's right. More to come.
Yeah, more to come. Let's talk about a number of them with Richard Freeman, the Arlene and Alan F. Smith Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. Richard, it's good to have you back.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the high-profile cases. One of them, the Supreme Court ruled in the 6-3 decision that federal border agents have an easier path to deploy unlawful permanent residents like green card holders who are suspected of certain crimes. How significant is this change from like clear and convincing evidence to just belief that maybe there was a crime committed?
Yeah, I mean, it could be significant. They don't really elaborate what the standard is now at the border. Ultimately, the government is going to have to show that the green card holder did commit the crime. But what they're saying is that the border agent doesn't have to know that. So it's a little bit speculative just how much information they're going to have. Curious decision.
I want to ask you about this ExxonMobil situation. We're talking about a lawsuit over property seized by the Cuban government way back in 1960, over 65 years ago. Now ExxonMobil chasing more than $1 billion. How did a dispute from the Cold War era suddenly find its second wind in the 2020s?
Yeah, it's a curious story. The Congress in the 90s passed something called the Helms-Burton Act, which gave companies in a position like ExxonMobil the opportunity to sue, but it also gave the president the authority to suspend the ability if the president thought that was in the nation's interest.
Yeah.
And presidents kept suspending it until the first Trump administration. And he said, we're not getting anywhere with diplomacy. So let the lawsuits run.
Does this mean, does this ruling mean that the Supreme Court just kind of handed a massive permanent tool to corporate America to rewrite U.S.-Cuba relations? Regardless of what future presidents want.
Yeah. There's significant amounts of money at stake now. I mean, ExxonMobil has a problem. Even if it wins this suit, collecting is not going to be an easy matter. But it would give the ability, to go after Cuban assets in friendly countries. We give it the ability to go after assets, perhaps of companies that deal with Cuba in the United States. So, it could have a good deal of significance. Of course, that at least arguably was the purpose of Congress in passing this the statute. Now the three liberal justices said that it didn't really provide a an exemption from the ordinary foreign sovereign immunity standard, but the majority saw it differently.
Well, or does this open up an opportunity for companies to go after federal governments or to go after other foreign governments if there were property seized outside of just Cuba?
I think this is a Cuba-specific provision.
Okay.
Yeah.
I also want to ask about this Rastafarian man down in Louisiana. He sued a Louisiana prison after they forcibly cut his dreadlocks. He said it was a violation of his religious beliefs, but the court didn't agree.
Well, yeah, they said that he didn't have the right to sue the individual officers. I mean, he's caught in something of a bind. Some years ago, the Supreme Court said that state governments don't have any obligation to make accommodations from generally applicable laws for religious observances. So, you know, the prisons have standards on hair length. And so as a matter of constitutional law, he didn't have a right to keep his dreadlocks. Okay, but Congress didn't like that Supreme Court decision on, you know, not requiring accommodations. So they've passed a couple of statutes trying to limit the effect. And one of them said if you're an institution that or a federal prison, state prison receiving federal funds, then you have to agree to allow this kind of lawsuit. But the court some years ago said, well, sorry, you can't, that doesn't overcome the state's immunity from suits for damages in court. And okay, well, then he said, I'll go after the private individuals. And now the court said, sorry, doesn't work. The private individuals weren't the recipients of the funds. Mm-hmm. They treated it like a contract. It's like, okay, the state's made a contract with the federal government saying if we receive funds, then, you know, we're subject to limits, although they'd kind of knock those out. But the individuals never did. So he's out of luck. It's quite remarkable.
I know Justice Jackson wrote that, you know, a pretty stinging dissent where she said that after this ruling, state prison officials now have little incentive to abide by federal law, even if it's handed to them on a piece of paper. So if a guard can literally throw a federal court order in the trash and find zero personal financial face, you know, those financial consequences, has the Supreme Court effectively made religious liberty laws toothless inside of state prisons?
Well, I think what the majority would say is, look, he did not have a federal constitutional right to keep his dreadlocks because he was subject to a neutral general law of general applicability. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't give federal guards the authority to just to violate constitutional rights. Now, it could be that the court in time is going to revisit that principle on laws of general applicability, but they haven't done so yet.
Mm. Interesting. We just have 30 seconds left here. This decision for a Michigan family in Isabella County looking to recover the full value of their home. It was seized, sold in a tax foreclosure. They sided with the family, too.
Well, the court said, the immediate impact of this is that the sale seems to have been okay. We'll have to see what the lower court does, but the Punk family was saying, hey, you got to give us the fair market value of the property. And the court said, no, you know, you get what you get out of the sale. It was less than half the property. Mm-hmm. It's tough luck. Maybe you should have gotten a loan or gotten somebody else to buy it or, you know, refinance. Now, he may, on remand, he may be able to show that the government should have seized personal property or seized less of it. But we'll see what happens.
Well, busy day on the court yesterday. Richard Friedman, we always appreciate your insight and help.
Kind of break it down to us.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Coming up on the other side, we'll get a World Cup update. Jonathan Savage joins us. And the Europeans are absolutely loving the United States. We'll talk about it coming up on JR Morning.